Webb rubbed his hand against the bullet gouges on the brick. Many were so deep, Webb could see the concrete block underneath. Armor-piercing, for sure. The only good thing was death for his team would have been instantaneous. The snipers had to see something. He was hoping they had seen whatever had made Webb freeze. Yet how could they? "I haven't finished talking to them," was all Bates would offer on that point. And again, Webb chose not to press it. "Where's the kid?" Webb hesitated, trying to remember. "Kevin." Bates also hesitated for a second. "Disappeared." Webb stiffened. "How? He's a kid." "I'm not saying he did it on his own."
"We know who he is?"
"Kevin Westbrook, age 10. Got some family around, but most are guests of the state. Has an older brother, street name of Big F. The F standing for what you think it does. Head street ganger as big as a tree and smart as a Harvard MBA. Deals in meth, Jamaican sensimilla, the really cool stuff, though we've never been able to build a case against him. This area is sort of his turf." Webb stretched the fingers of his injured hand. The Band-Aid wasn't doing the trick right now, and he felt guilty for even thinking about it.
"That's a pretty big coincidence that the little brother of the guy who runs this area was sitting out in the alley when we came by."
Even as he talked about the boy, Webb could feel a change come over his body, as though his very soul were sliding out and moving on. He actually thought he might pass out. Webb was starting to wonder if he needed a doctor or an exorcist. "Well, he does live around here. And from what we found out, his home life isn't all that great. He probably avoided it if he could."
"This big brother missing too?"
Webb asked as his balance began to return. "Not that he actually lives at a normal address. When you're in the kind of business he is, you keep moving. We don't have any direct evidence tying him to even a misdemeanor, but we're looking for him real hard right now."
He stared at Webb.
"You sure you're okay?"
Webb waved off this comment. "How exactly did you lose the kid?"
"That's not real clear right now. We'll know more after we finish going through the neighborhood. Somebody had to see those weapons coming in and that machine gun nest being put up. Even around here, that qualifies as a little unusual."
"You really think anybody here is going to talk to you?"
"We have to try, Webb. We only need one pair of eyes." The men fell silent for a while. Bates finally looked up, his expression uncomfortable.
"Webb, what really happened?"
"Say what you really mean. How come it wasn't a perfect 7-for-7?
"I am saying it."
Webb gazed across the courtyard at the exact spot where he had hit the asphalt.
"I came out of the alley late. It was like I couldn't move. I thought I'd had a stroke. Then I went down right before the shooting started. I don't know why."
Webb's mind suddenly went blank and then came back, like he was a television and there had been a lightning strike nearby.
"It was over in a second, Purse. A second was all it took. The worst timing in the history of the world."
He looked at Bates to gauge his reaction to this. The narrowed eyes of the man told Webb all he needed to know.
"Hell, don't feel bad. I don't believe it either," said Webb.
Bates remained silent, and Webb decided to get to the other reason he had come here.
"Where's the flag?" he asked.
Bates looked surprised.
"The HRT flag. I have to bring it back to Quantico."
On every mission HRT undertook, the senior member was given the HRT flag to carry with him in his gear. When the mission was completed, the flag was to be returned to the HRT commander by the senior member of the team. Well, now that happened to be Webb.
"Follow me," said Bates.
An FBI van was parked at the curb. Bates popped open one of the back doors, reached in and pulled out a flag folded military style. He handed it to Webb. Webb held the flag in both hands, staring down at the colors for a moment, every detail of the slaughter once more working through his head.
"It's got a few holes in it," Bates observed.
"Don't we all?" said Webb.
Chapter 5. The following day, Webb headed down to Quantico to the HRT facility. He drove along Marine Corps Route 4, past the campus-style FBI Academy that was home to both FBI and DEA grunts. Webb had spent 13 very intense and stressful weeks of his life at the Academy learning how to be an FBI agent. In return, Webb was paid peanuts and lived in a dorm room with a shared bath, and he even had to bring his own towels. And Webb had loved it and had devoted every waking moment to becoming the best FBI agent he could, because he felt he had been born for the job. Webb had walked out of the Academy as a newly minted and sworn agent of the FBI with his Smith & Wesson 357 wheel gun, which required a staggering 9 pounds of pull to fire. Rarely did one shoot oneself in the foot with the weapon. Recruits now carried 40-caliber Glock semi-automatics with 14-round magazines with a much easier trigger pull. But Webb still had fond memories of his Smith & Wesson with the 3-inch bull barrel. Fancier didn't necessarily mean better. He had spent the next 6 years learning how to be an FBI agent in the field. He had sweated through the infamous FBI paperwork mountain, ferreted out leads, drummed up informants, answered criminal complaints, kept his butt on wiretaps, undertaken all-night surveillances, built up cases, and arrested people who badly needed to be. Webb had gotten to the point where he could concoct a battle plan in 5 minutes while he was driving a bureau car, or BU car as it was always called, 110 miles an hour down the highway, steering with his knees and shoving shells into his shotgun. He had learned how to interrogate suspects, establishing baselines and then asking them tough questions designed to knock them for a loop, to later gauge when they were lying. He had also learned how to testify without being cracked by slick defense lawyers, whose only goal was to not discover the truth and instead to bury it. His superiors, including Percy Bates, when Webb had been transferred to the Washington field office after several years in the Midwest, had filled his personnel file with commendation after commendation, impressed with his dedication, his physical and mental skills, and his ability to think on his feet. He had worked outside the rules at certain points, yet most of the really good agents did, he thought, because some of the bureau rules were just plain stupid. That was also something Percy Bates had taught him. Webb parked, got out of the car, and headed into HRT's building, which would never be termed beautiful by anyone who could actually see. He was welcomed with open arms, and tough, hardened men, who had seen more death and danger than the average citizen could possibly imagine, broke down with him in private rooms. HRT was not a place where anyone rushed to show his vulnerabilities and emotions. No man wanted to be firing guns and risking his life next to the shy, sensitive type. You left your warm, fuzzy aura at the door and just brought your alpha male, kick-ass side to work. Everything here was based on seniority and ability. Those two attributes usually, though not always, paralleled each other. Webb returned the flag to his commander. Webb's chief, a lean, muscular man with salt-and-pepper hair and a former HRT operator who could still outwork most of his men, accepted the flag with dignity and a handshake that dissolved into an embrace in the privacy of the man's office. Well, thought Webb, at least they didn't hate his guts. The HRT's admin building had been built to hold 50 personnel, yet now 100 people called it their home away from home. There was a two-holer for all those folks, so the P-lines were long, even for elite crime-busting feds. There were small offices behind the reception area for the commander, who was at the rank of an ASAC, or assistant special agent in charge, and his down-the-line chain of command that consisted of one supervisor for assaulters and one for snipers. The HRT operators had honeycomb cubicle areas across the hallway from each other, split between snipers and assaulters. There was only one classroom in the building, which also doubled as a conference and briefing room in the space-challenged complex. There was a line of coffee mugs on a shelf on the rear wall of the room. Whenever the choppers landed here, the force of the blades would make the mugs vibrate. Somehow that sound had always been very soothing to Webb. Team members coming home safe, he supposed. He stopped by to see Anne Lyle, who worked in the office. Anne was 60, much older than the other women who worked in administration, and could be truly termed the matriarch and unofficial mother hen of the hardcore lads who called HRT home. The unwritten rule was that you did not curse around Anne or use any other sort of uncouth language or gestures. Both rookie and veteran operators who ran afoul of this policy quickly found themselves the target of retribution, ranging from glue in their helmets to taking a particularly hard shot during a training drill, the kind that left you wondering if one of your lungs had fallen out. Anne had been with HRT almost since its inception, after working at the WFO for many years, and had become a widow during that time. Childless, she let her entire life revolve around her work, and she listened to the young single agents and their problems and doled out sensible advice. She also served as HRT's unofficial marriage counselor and had on more than one occasion prevented a divorce. She had come to Webb's hospital room every day while he was waiting to get his face back, far more often than his own mother had bothered to. Anne regularly brought home-baked goodies to the office, and she was known as the primary information source for all things having to do with the Bureau and HRT. She was also a whiz at navigating the Bureau's requisition morass, and if HRT needed something, no matter how big or small, Anne Lyle made sure they got it. He found Anne in her office, closed the door, and sat across from her. Anne's hair had been white for several years now, and her body had lost its shape, but her eyes were still youthful-looking, and her smile was truly beautiful. Anne rose from her desk and gave Webb a much-needed hug. Her cheeks were wet from tears. She had been especially close to the members of Charlie Team, who took great pains to show her their affection for all she did for them. "You don't look good, Webb."
"I've had better days."
"I wouldn't wish this on anybody, not even my worst enemy," she said. "But you're the last person in the world this should have happened to, Webb. Right now, all I want to do is scream and never stop."
"I appreciate that, Anne," said Webb. "I still don't know what happened, really. I've never frozen like that before."
"Webb, honey, you've spent the last 8 years of your life getting shot at. Don't you think that adds up? You're only human."
"That's just it, Anne. I'm supposed to be more than that. That's why I'm at HRT.
"What you need is a good long rest. When's the last time you took a vacation? Do you even remember?"
"What I need is some information, and I need you to help me get it."
Anne accepted this change in subject without comment.
"I'll do what I can, you know that."
"An undercover named Randall Cove. He's MIA.
"That name sounds familiar. I think I knew a Cove when I worked at WFO. You say he's gone missing?"
"He was the inside guy on the HRT hit. Guess he was either in on it or else got his cover blown. I need whatever you can find on him. Addresses, aliases, known contacts, the works."
"If he was working in D.C., his home won't be around there," said Anne. "There's an unofficial 25-mile rule for UCs. You don't want to run into one of your neighbors while you're working your shift. For big-time assignments, they might even bring the agent in from another part of the country."
"Understood, but 25 miles out still leaves a lot of possibilities. Maybe we can get a record of phone logs, communications with WFO, that sort of thing." I don't know how you manage it, but I really need whatever you can get.
UCs mostly use disposable phone cards with low amounts on them to call in with. Buy them at convenience stores, use them up, chuck them, and buy another. No record of anything that way.
Webb's hopes dimmed. So there's no way to trace?
He had never had to track down an undercover agent before.
Anne smiled her beautiful smile.
Oh, Webb, there's always a way. You just let me dig around a little.
He looked at his hands. I'm feeling kind of like a guy at the Alamo that the Mexicans somehow missed.
Anne nodded in understanding. There's some fresh coffee in the kitchen and a chocolate walnut cake I brought in. Go help yourself, Webb. You've always been too skinny.
Her next words made Webb look up into that wonderfully reassuring face.
And I'm watching your back here, honey. Don't think that I'm not. I know what's what, Webb. I hear everything, uptown or down. And nobody, and I mean nobody, is going to pull anything on you while I'm sitting here.
As he walked out, Webb wondered if Anne Lyle would ever consider adopting him. Webb found an empty computer terminal and logged on to HRT's database. It had occurred to him, as he was sure it had to others, that his team's annihilation might have been a simple case of revenge. He spent considerable time going through past cases where HRT had been called up. Memories came flooding back to him of chest-thudding victories and heart-wrenching failures. The problem was that if you added up all the people who had been affected by an HRT mission and factored in family and friends, along with fringe crazies chasing any cause they could get their demented hands around, the numbers ran into the thousands. Webb would have to leave that to somebody else to run down. He was certain the Bureau computers were crunching that data right now. Webb passed down the main hallway and lingered in front of the photo displays of past HRT operations. Here, there were visual images of many stunning successes. The credo of hostage rescue was speed, surprise, and violence of action, and HRT put big-time action to those words. Webb looked at a photo of a terrorist on the most wanted list who had been plucked from international waters, grabs, they called them, like an unsuspecting crab taken from a sand hole, and whisked away to stand trial with a lifelong prison term to follow. There were photos of a joint international task force operation on a drug farm in a Latin American country. And finally, there was a picture of a very tense hostage situation in a high-rise government building in Chicago. The result was all hostages were saved, with three of the five hostage takers dead. Unfortunately, it didn't always work that way. He walked outside the admin building and observed the lone tree there. It was a species of the state tree of Kansas, planted there in memory of the HRT operator who had been killed in a training accident and who had hailed from there. Each time Webb had passed that tree, he had said a silent prayer that it would be the only one they would ever have to plant. So much for answered prayers. Soon they'd have a damn forest here. Webb really needed to be doing something, anything that would make him not feel like a total failure. He went to the equipment cage, snagged a .308 snipe rifle and some ammo, and headed back out. He needed to calm down, and ironically, firing guns did that for him, as it required a precision and focus that would block out all other thoughts, however troubling. He passed the HRT's original headquarters building, which was narrow and tall and looked like a glorified grain silo instead of home for an elite law enforcement unit. Then he stood and looked out at the sheared-off hillside where one of the shooting ranges was situated. There was a new 1,000-yard rifle range, and work crews were in the process of leveling an adjacent forest in order to add to the HRT's ever-growing complex, which also included a new indoor shooting range facility. Behind the outdoor shooting range, the trees were leafy green. It had always seemed an odd juxtaposition to Webb, nature's beautiful colors serving as a backdrop to where he had stood for so many years, learning better ways to kill.
Yet he was the good guy, and that made it all right. At least that's what the bill of goods that came with the badge had very strongly implied. He set up his targets. Webb was going to play a game of sniper's poker. The cards were slightly fanned out across the target holder, such that only the tiniest portion of each card, other than the front card, was visible. The goal was to build a winning hand. The trick was you could only count a card that you hit cleanly. If your round even nicked another card, you couldn't claim the card you were shooting at. And you only got 5 shots. The margin of error was impossibly tiny. It was just the sort of nerve-wracking task to relax a person, if that person happened to be an HRT grunt. Webb set himself up 100 yards away from the targets. Lying flat on the ground, he placed a small beanbag under the 308 stock to support his upper body weight as he settled in. He aligned his body with the recoil path to minimize muzzle jump. His hips were flat against the ground, his knees spread shoulder width, and ankles flat to the ground to shrink his target profile in case someone was aiming at him. Webb dialed the proper settings on the scope's calibration wheel and figured in wind, too. The humidity was high, so he added an extra half-minute click. As a sniper, every shot he had ever fired during a mission had been recorded in his log. It was a very valuable record of environmental effects on bullets fired, and also might explain why a sniper had missed a target, which was the only time anybody gave a damn. When you hit your target, you were just doing your job. You didn't get a key to the city. There was no detail too small when it concerned killing at long range. A hint of a shadow across your objective lens could easily make the less than vigilant shooter wipe out a hostage rather than the person holding him. Webb lightly squeezed the pebbled pistol grip. He pulled the stock to his shoulder, pressed his cheek to the stock, set the proper eye relief, and gripped the butt pad with his weak hand to steady the 308's bipod. He sucked in a breath, eased it out. No muscle could come between Webb and his sniping. Muscle was erratic. He needed bone on bone, because bone didn't flinch. Webb had always used the ambush technique when sniping. This entailed the shooter waiting until the target entered a predetermined kill zone. The sniper would plant his crosshairs just ahead of the target, and then count the mil dots in the reticle to calculate distance to target, angle of incidence, and speed. You also had to judge elevation, wind, and humidity, and then you waited to kill, like the proverbial spider in the web. You always shot into the skull for a very simple reason. Targets shot in the head never fired back. Bone on bone, pulse at 64. Webb let out one last breath. His finger slid to the trigger, and he fired 5 shots with the precise motion of a man who had done this very thing well over 50,000 times. He repeated the process 4 more times, 3 times at 100 yards, and the last hand of poker was played out at 200 yards, which was the outer reaches of distance for sniper's poker. When he checked the targets, Webb had to smile. He had a royal flush in spades on 2 hands, aces with king high on 2 others, and a full house on the hand at 200 yards. And not one mark on any other card. And not one round thrown either, which in bureau parlance meant not a shot missed. This allowed him to feel good about himself for about 10 seconds, and then the depression came roaring back. He returned the weapon to the equipment cage and continued his stroll. Over at the adjacent Marine Corps facility was the Yellow Brick Road, which was a hellish 7.5-mile obstacle course with 15-foot rope drops, bare pits with barbed wire just waiting for a slip and fall, and also sheer rock cliffs. During his HRT qualification days, Webb had run that course so many times he had memorized every single disgusting inch of it. Team events had involved 15-mile runs,
loaded with upward of 50 pounds of gear and precious objects carried, such as bricks that must not touch the ground lest your team lose. There were also swims through icy, filthy water, and 50-foot-long ladders pointed straight to God. That had been followed by a trek up Heartbreak Hotel, a mere 4-story jaunt, and the optional, yeah, leap off the gunwale of an old ship into the James River. Since Webb's joining HRT, Heartbreak Hotel had been tamed somewhat, with guide wires, railings, and nets. It was undoubtedly safer, but in his opinion, a lot less fun. Still, those with a fear of heights most definitely need not apply. Rappelling from choppers into thick forest really separated the men from the boys, where if you missed your breakpoint, a 100-foot oak got to know your insides far too well. And along the way to graduation, each recruit had to navigate the hothouse, which was a 3-story concrete tower with steel shutters over the windows, welded shut. The interior configuration, with its mesh floors, allowed a fire at the bottom to shoot smoke all the way to the top in seconds. The luckless recruit got thrown into the 3rd floor and had to use his sense of touch, guts, and instincts to find his way to the bottom and out to safety. Your reward for surviving that was a bucket of water in the eyes to clear out the smoke there, and the chance to do it again a few minutes later with a 150-pound dummy on your back. Crammed in between all that was tens of thousands of rounds fired, classroom drills that would have perplexed and confounded Einstein, fitness grinders that would have left many an Olympian heaving from exhaustion, plus enough paralyzing split-second decision-making scenarios to make a man give up booze and women, crawl in a padded room, and start talking to himself. And every step of the way were the real HRT operators, grading your sorry butt on every mistake and every triumph, and you just hoped you ended up with far more of the latter. But you never really could tell, because the HRTs never talked to you. To them, you were scum. Busting your ass scum, but still scum. And you knew they wouldn't even acknowledge your presence until and if you graduated. Hell, they probably wouldn't even attend your funeral if the tryout managed to kill you. Webb had somehow survived it all, and upon graduation from the New Operators Training School, or NOTS as it was known, he had been drafted as a sniper and spent 2 more months at the Scout Sniper School of the Marine Corps, where he had learned from the very best the skills of fieldcraft, observation, camouflage, and killing with rifle and scope. After that, Webb had spent over 7 years as first a sniper and later an assaulter, either being bored to death at long standoffs, often in miserable conditions, or else shooting or being shot at all over the world by some of its most deranged inhabitants. In return, he got all the guns and ammo he wanted, and a pay scale equivalent to what a 16-year-old could earn programming computers during his lunch hour. All in all, it had been really cool. Webb walked by the hangar facility, which housed the team's big Bell 412 helicopters, and the much smaller MD-530s, which they all referred to as the Little Birds, because they were fast and agile and could carry 4 men on the inside and 4 more on the skids at a speed of 120 knots. Webb had ridden the Little Birds into some hellish situations, and the 530s had always brought him back out, a couple of times dangling upside down from a rope hooked to the chopper's swing arm. Yet Webb had never been picky about exactly how he survived a mission. The motor pool was behind a chain-link fence. Webb stopped and zipped up his jacket against a chilly wind. The sky was quickly becoming overcast as a storm system swept into the area, something it routinely did this time of day at this time of year. He went inside the fence and sat atop the team's sole armored personnel carrier, a hand-me-down gift from the Army. His gaze swept across the row of parked Suburbans. The vehicles had been reconfigured with ladder packages, such that they could drive right up to a building and extend the ladder and go knock-knock surprise on the fifth floor of some criminal's lair. There were mount-out trucks that carried their gear, jet skis, food service trucks, and a rigid hull boat with inflatable gunnels that had been designed by Navy SEALs. The thing had twin Chrysler V8s, whose effect Webb could only equate to being inside a building while it was being demolished via wrecking ball. He had ridden in it on numerous occasions, or more aptly, had survived it. They had it all here, from equipment for jungle assaults to Arctic expeditions. They trained for every contingency, put everything they had into the work. And yet they could still be beaten by coincidence, by the blundering luck of inferior opponents, or by the skillful planning and insider knowledge of a traitor. It started to rain, so Webb ducked inside the training facility, which was a large warehouse-style building with long corridors to simulate hallways in hotels and movable rubber-coated walls. It was very much like a Hollywood studio backlot. If they were lucky enough to get the blueprints of a target, HRT would reconstruct it on-site here and train within exact parameters. The last set they had built here was for the operation where Charlie had ceased to be. As Webb studied this configuration, it hadn't occurred to him that he would never see the insides of the actual target for real. They had never even gotten to the front door. He hoped they would tear out the guts of this place soon, get it ready for the next operation. The result couldn't be any worse, could it? The rubber-coated walls here absorbed the slugs, for HRT often practiced with live fire. Stairways were made of wood that would not allow ricochets. However, the team had discovered, fortunately without serious injury, that the nails in the wood could catch a bullet and send it on to unintended places. He passed by the aircraft fuselage mock-up that had been constructed so they could practice on skyjacking scenarios. It hung from the rafters and could be raised or lowered for training purposes. How many imaginary terrorists had he shot down in here? The training had paid off, for he had done it for real when an American airliner had been stormed in Rome. The terrorists had ordered the plane flown to Turkey and then on to Manila. Webb and crew had gone wheels up at Andrews Air Force Base within 2 hours of learning of the skyjacking. They had followed the hijacked plane's movements from their airborne perch in a USAF C-141. On the ground at Manila, where the jetliner was being refueled, the terrorists had tossed out 2 dead hostages, both Americans, one of them a 4-year-old girl. A political statement, they proudly announced. It was the last one they would ever make. The hijacked plane's takeoff had been delayed, first by weather and then by mechanical failure. At around midnight local time, Webb and his Charlie team had boarded the plane disguised as mechanics. 3 minutes after they got on the plane, there were 5 dead terrorists and no more slain hostages. Webb had shot one of them with his .45 directly through the Diet Coke can the guy had been holding up to his mouth. To this day, he still couldn't drink the stuff. Yet he never regretted pulling the trigger. The image of an innocent little girl's body on the tarmac, American, Iranian, Japanese, it didn't matter to Webb, was all the motivation he would ever need to keep pulling the trigger at rank evil. These guys could claim all the geopolitical oppression in the world, call upon all the grand and omniscient deities in their religious warehouses, make every half-assed justification they wanted to, so they could detonate their bombs and fire their weapons, and none of it meant a damn thing to Webb when they started killing innocent people, and in particular, kids. And he would fight them for as long as they wanted to perform their perverted little dance of sin and mayhem across the globe, for wherever they could go, so could he. Webb moved through small rubber-walled rooms where posters of bad guys pointing guns at him hung on support poles. He instinctively drew a bead with his finger and blew them away. With an armed person, you always keyed on hands, not the eyes, because no one in history had ever been killed by a pair of eyes. As he lowered his gun, Webb had to smile. It was all so easy when no one was actually firing at you. In other rooms were the heads and upper torsos of dummies on poles, their skin and bulk replicating that of a real human. Webb threw side kicks to their heads, followed by a series of paralyzing kidney punches, and then moved on. From inside one room, he heard some movement and looked in. The man there had on a tank shirt and cami pants and was wiping the sweat from his muscular neck, shoulders, and arms. Long ropes dangled from the ceiling. This was one of the rooms where the men practiced their fast roping skills. Webb watched as the man went up and down three times with graceful, fluid motions, cords of muscles in his arms and shoulders tensing and then relaxing. When the man finished, Webb stepped inside and said, "Hey, Ken, don't you ever take a day off?" Ken McCarthy looked over at Webb, and his gaze was not exactly what Webb would have called friendly. McCarthy was one of the snipers who had been overhead along the alley the night Charlie Team had disappeared under the wave of 50s. McCarthy was black, 34 years of age, a Texan by birth, as well as an Army brat who had seen the world on Uncle Sam's dime. He was a former SEAL, yet did not exude the flagrant cockiness that most SEALs tended to. Only 5'10", he could bench press a truck and held advanced multi-degree black belts in three different martial arts. He was the most skilled water operator HRT had, and he could also place a bullet between a person's eyes at 1,000 yards in the dead of night while straddling a tree limb. A 3-year veteran of HRT, he was quiet, kept mostly to himself, and lacked the ghoulish sense of humor that most operators had. Webb had taught him things McCarthy hadn't known or was having trouble picking up, and in return, McCarthy had shared some of his remarkable skills with Webb. To Webb's knowledge, McCarthy had never had a problem with him, yet the man's look right now possibly heralded an end to that streak. Maybe Romano had turned everyone against him. "What are you doing here, Webb? Figured you'd still be in the hospital nursing your injuries." Webb took another step toward the man. He didn't like McCarthy's tone or words, yet he could understand where they were coming from. Webb could also understand where Romano was coming from, too. It was just that sort of a place. You were expected to do your job perfectly. Perfection was all they asked for here. Webb hadn't come close. Sure, he had knocked out the guns after the fact. That counted for zip with these men. "I take it you saw it all." McCarthy slipped off a pair of workout gloves and rubbed his thick, heavily calloused fingers. "Would have fast roped down to the alley, but Toc told us to sit tight." "There was nothing you could do, Ken." McCarthy was still looking at his feet. "Finally got the go-ahead. Took too long. Hooked up with hotel. Took damn way too long," he said again. "We kept stopping, trying to raise you guys on the mic. Toc didn't know what the hell was going on. Our chain of command sort of broke down. Guess you knew that." "We were prepared for everything except what went down." McCarthy sat on the rubber mat floor and drew his knees up. He glanced up at Webb. "Heard you were a little late coming out of the alley and that you kind of fell down or something." "Or something." He sat down next to McCarthy. "The guns were triggered by a laser, but the laser was probably activated by a remote, so the 50s wouldn't kick on prematurely and hit the wrong target. Somebody had to be around there to do that." Webb let that last statement hang as his gaze remained on McCarthy. "I've already talked to WFO. "I'm sure. It's an ongoing AFO, Webb," he said. An AFO was an investigation of an assault on a federal officer. Actually, lots of them in this case. "I know all that too, Ken. Look, I'm not sure what happened to me. I didn't plan it that way. I did all I could." Webb drew a long breath.
And if I could take it all back right now, I would. And I've got to live with that every day of my life, Ken. I hope you can understand that.
McCarthy lifted his head and his hostile look faded. There was nothing to shoot, Webb. There wasn't a damn thing for the snipers to blow away. All that training and no party to show it off at. We had three guys on the buildings overlooking the courtyard, and not one of them could get even a decent bead on the miniguns. Hell, they were afraid to fire because they thought one of their ricochets might nail you.
How about the kid? Did you see the kid?
The little black kid? Yeah, when he came down the alley with your cap and the note.
We passed him going in, too.
You guys must have blocked our view. And the light in that alley really reflected weird up where we were.
Okay, how about the other guys? The dudes doing the drugs?
We had a sniper on them the whole time. They never left where they were until the firing started. Then they took off running. Jeffries said they seemed as surprised as anybody. When Toc gave us the green light, we took off.
What happened then?
Hooked up with hotel, like I said. We saw the flare, stopped, fanned out. Then the kid came to us. We got the note, your warning. Everett and Palmer went forward as scouts. Too damn late.
McCarthy paused here, and Webb saw a single tear slide down the man's youthful, handsome features. Normal features like what Webb had once possessed.
I never heard gunfire like that in my life, Webb. I've never felt helpless like that in my whole life.
You did your job, Ken, and that's all you can do.
Webb paused and then said,
They can't seem to find the kid. Know anything about that?
McCarthy shook his head.
Couple guys from hotel took charge of him. Romano and Cortez, I think.
Romano again. Shit. That meant Webb had to go talk to the man. What did you do?
I went into the courtyard with some of the others. We saw you, but you were out of it.
He looked down again.
And we saw the rest of Charlie.
He glanced at Webb.
A couple of the snipers told me how you went back out there, Webb. They saw what you did and still can't believe you did it. Said you must have the luck of the Irish somewhere in your back pocket to have gone back out there. I don't think I could have.
Yes, you would, Ken. And you would have done it better than me.
McCarthy seemed startled at this praise.
After you came back out of the courtyard, did you see the kid?
McCarthy thought about this.
I remember him sitting on a trash can. By that time, everybody was showing up.
Did you see any suits take custody of the kid?
McCarthy thought again.
No, I sort of recall Romano talking to somebody, but that's all.
Did you recognize any of them?
You know we don't interface with the regulars that much.
How about DEA?
That's all I can tell you, Webb.
You've been talking to Romano?
A little.
Don't believe everything you hear, Ken. It's not healthy.
Including from you?
McCarthy asked pointedly.
Including from me.
As Webb drove away from Quantico, he realized he had a lot of ground to cover. This was officially not his investigation, yet in some ways it was more his than anyone else's. But he had to take care of something else first, something even more important than finding out who had set up his team. And finding out what had happened to a little boy with a bullet hole on his cheek and no shirt to his name.